Craig Murray was being fast-tracked for the top. At 26, he had entered the British Foreign Service, top of his year's intake. The speed of his rise in the service was almost unprecedented, and aged just 43, he was appointed British ambassador to Uzbekistan. He was happy to move to the capital, Tashkent, with his wife and two children. It was, everyone agreed, the start of a glittering ambassadorial career. But in August 2002, Craig Murray had a choice to make.
I'd been there for literally just a couple of weeks when I attended the trial of a dissident, largely to get a feel for how the state operated and what was going on the political side. The guy's name was Huda Bagainov. He was charged, along with five other people, of a series of crimes. I went to the courtroom, which was in an old Soviet building, rather crumbling building. It was an incredibly hot day. It was about 45 degrees centigrade. We went down into the basement where the trial was held. On the way down, the staircase was lined by paramilitaries in camouflage uniforms holding machine guns. And in the courtroom itself, which was a cramped basement room, the prisoners were kept in a cage, and there were some 16 armed guards around that cage with machine guns. Half of them facing the court, the other half facing in at the prisoners. I can only compare it to videos I've seen of Hitler's show trials. The judge was haranguing the accused. He was making jokes about the Islamic faith, saying, "I'm surprised you could find time to commit so many crimes when you have to stop and pay five times a day." Stuff like that. And one thing which stood in my mind very strongly was an old guy came to give evidence, and he was a hunched old man with a long grey beard, wearing an oriental gown, and he spoke in a very quiet, rather defeated voice, and he'd given evidence that two of the accused, who were his nephews, were members of Al-Qaeda and had travelled to Afghanistan, where they had met Osama bin Laden in person. And as he gave his evidence, suddenly from within himself somewhere, he seemed to gain a new strength, and he stood tall, and he said in a much stronger voice, "It's not true. This is not true. They tortured my children in front of me until I signed up to this. We didn't even know who Osama bin Laden was. We're just poor farmers from Andijan. What do we know about Osama bin Laden?" And it's hard to describe because it's not entirely a rational thing. It's intuitive. But I could have touched him when he said that. He was very, very close to me in this extremely cramped and sweaty basement courtroom. And I could just tell at that moment he was telling the truth. It rang true. It was really pretty hideous to be there and know that, people were liable to be executed as a result of this trial. It turned out that over 20 other people had been convicted of the murder of the two policemen. And that's something the Uzbek authorities do regularly. If a crime is committed, and unfortunately two policemen had been murdered, they will use that one crime to sweep up a lot of dissidents and find them guilty of it. And in the middle of this hopeless situation, Huda Bagainov himself, the alleged leader of this group, who was a young guy, he was about 20 years old but looked younger, was painfully thin. He caught my eye, and of course I stood out as a Westerner in this crowd, and I was wearing a three-piece suit, and it was really striking. He caught my eye, and you could see hope come into his eyes, as though someone had come from outside who might be going to rescue him. And that moment made me realise that I had to try to help people caught up in this appalling system. At pretty well exactly the same time as the trial, either the day before or the day after, I received this envelope of photographs. The member of staff who gave them to me said, "You might not want to open these." So I got them out of my desk. I looked at them. and they were photos of a corpse in a quite appalling state. The guy's name was Mr. Avazov. He was a member of a dissident Muslim group called Hizb ut-Tahrir, and he'd been a prisoner in the Jazlik Gulag, an old Soviet gulag in the desert. And his corpse had been delivered back to his mother, who'd got the body out onto the kitchen table and taken the detailed photos which we received.
When we wanted to open the box and see what his body looked like, they didn't let us. Then we sent them away and opened it. He used to be quite a fat man, and what we saw was just skin and bones. There was a big scar on his head, huge scar from his throat down to his stomach. His ribs were broken. The skin on his body was burned. On his liver was a mark from electrical element. His nails were ripped off. The moment I saw his body, I lost consciousness. Despite the fact that he had died a day before, blood was still pouring from his body.
Looking at this corpse, there was nothing within my experience that could indicate what on earth could happen to a human being to reduce them to that condition. So I sent the photographs off to the University of Glasgow Pathology Department, who presented a report, because there were a number of detailed photos which told me what had happened. And the pathology report said that he died of immersion in boiling liquid. And it was immersion, not splashing, because there was a clear tide line across the torso and upper limbs. And what happened from then on was word got around that the British Embassy was now investigating cases and taking an interest. They started to come to me. I met victims of torture. I met people with photographs showing evidence of torture. I met families of people who'd been tortured. I had letters smuggled to me out of the gulags. And this picture of systematic torture started to build up, and I realised it was used in Uzbekistan on what I can only call an industrial scale, affecting thousands of people every year. And at first, the Uzbek leadership tried to simply poo-poo my efforts. In the boiling case, their explanation was that the man, Mr. Avazov, had died in a fight with a fellow prisoner over a tea kettle, and that's what had caused the scalding, which was obviously a quite extraordinary and stupid explanation, but it was one which some of my fellow ambassadors were keen to accept.
They're the sorts of stories we were used to hearing about the rogue states of Asia, which in 2002 were becoming targets in the war on terror. Except that President Karimov's Uzbekistan didn't feature on the axis of evil.
At this time, Uzbekistan was viewed by the United States as a key ally in the war on terror and a member of a coalition of the willing in Iraq. It was very important to America because they didn't have many Asian members of a coalition of the willing. And of course, it's immediately north of Afghanistan and a very short distance from Iran, which puts it in a strategic position. So America was giving a great deal of aid to the Karimov regime. In order to be able to continue that level of aid, due to congressional restrictions, the US State Department has to certify the human rights record of the regime receiving the aid. And I was completely astonished in 2002 when Colin Powell signed off a certification to Congress that the human rights situation in Uzbekistan was improving. I was aware that I was not doing what London wanted by refusing to turn a blind eye to the human rights abuses. I knew that what they really wanted me to do was spend my time on the cocktail party circuit and at the golf course and not leaving the gates of my residence too often, and certainly not to be rubbing their noses in human rights abuses by the Karimov regime. So I knew that wouldn't go down well at all with London, and I knew that that was likely to have a detrimental effect on my career. And that's something I worried about. It's something I discussed with my wife. It's something I discussed with other people in the embassy. But on the other hand, I never had any real doubt about what had to be done. It seemed to me that this was a regime just so appalling that there was absolutely no way but we could be going along with it. And after I'd been in Tashkent for a month, I decided that I had to send back advice to London that I felt our policy was fundamentally misguided. And I sat down at my desk and drafted a telegram, which I sent off on the 16th of September 2002, saying that I felt that the policy of backing a dictator like Karimov was a wrong policy, that ultimately was going to cause more problems than it would solve. I was well aware that this telegram would be extremely unpopular in London, and I did receive a letter from my immediate management telling me that they were afraid I was over-focused on human rights. I remember that precise phrase very well. I was over-focused on human rights to the detriment of the balance of UK interests. So London were trying to steer me away from human rights at that stage.
But, not discouraged, Murray sought a more public forum for his concerns. In keeping with diplomatic procedure, he sought and received approval for his next move, though it later emerged that that approval had been given accidentally.
I was invited to give a speech at the opening of Freedom House, an American NGO who were setting up in Tashkent. I cleared my speech through London, through the Foreign Office. But I was actually very fortunate in clearing the speech through, because I was later to discover through materials I obtained through the Data Protection Act that the head of the diplomatic service, Michael Jay, and my immediate management had been minuting each other, saying I should certainly not be allowed to make a speech like this that would upset the Uzbeks. Fortunately, somehow, that message didn't get through to the person who, at working level, was dealing with the clearing of my speech. It was a very, very crowded occasion, crowded venue. An awful lot of senior Uzbek politicians and oligarchs were there, as well as representatives from the NGOs and quite a lot of media, including international media. The American ambassador spoke first, and he gave the normal American take on things. He said that there were some problems in Uzbekistan which they had inherited from the Soviet Union, but luckily, you know, under this wise government of President Karimov, things were getting better. I then spoke and said, in effect, the absolute opposite of what the American ambassador had just said.
This country has made very disappointing progress in moving away from the dictatorship of the Soviet period. Uzbekistan is not a functioning democracy. The major political parties are banned. Parliament is not subject to democratic election. And checks and balances on the authority of the executive are lacking. There is worse. We believe there to be between 7,000 and 10,000 people in detention, whom we would consider as political and or religious prisoners. In many cases, they have been falsely convicted of crimes with which there appears to be no credible evidence they had any connection.
That really caused quite a sensation. I was very conscious as I made the speech that my words were having a sensational effect in the room. During the American ambassador's speech, there had been the normal kind of quiet hum you often get made under speeches. While I was talking, you could have heard a pin drop. What I did find was that the new hard line I was taking, what I was saying very straight to Uzbek ministers in meetings, gave me a much improved standard with the Uzbek government. They paid attention to me. They viewed me as a strong person and a factor that had to be taken into account. So I found, in fact, I became much more effective as an ambassador because I was taking this strong line than other ambassadors who the Uzbek government regarded as pretty weak and irrelevant.
Back home in London, though, Murray's maverick approach was the subject of much internal discussion at the Foreign Office. And he was about to raise the stakes even further, questioning not just the morality of British policy, but its legality.
As I was receiving people coming to me, telling me tales of being tortured or family members who'd been tortured, and I was getting all this information on torture, I was seeing the intelligence material provided by the CIA, and it said exactly the same things that people were being forced to sign up to under torture, that named dissidents were members of Al-Qaeda. And in one instance, for example, a dissident named as being a member of Al-Qaeda, I knew him and he happened to be a Jehovah's Witness. There aren't many Jehovah's Witnesses in Al-Qaeda. And I just give that as one example. There were many other examples of ways in which we knew the intelligence was basically untrue. But the consistent similarity between the stories people had to sign under torture and the dodgy intelligence produced by the CIA led me very quickly to the conclusion that the CIA were getting the material from the torture chambers. And we checked that with the American embassy, and they said, yes, it probably does come from torture, and we don't see that as a problem in the context of a war on terror. I really did see this as a major problem, and I therefore went back to London in internal telegram communications saying, we're getting intelligence from torture, this is wrong, it's morally wrong, it's illegal, and it's useless because the intelligence material is simply untrue. And it was at that stage that the Foreign Office in London and the British government really started to get angry with me. At that stage, they started to view me as dangerous. I was called over for a meeting in London, which took place in early March of 2003. At that meeting, I was told that it was not illegal for us to obtain intelligence under torture, provided we didn't do the torturing ourselves or specifically request that a named individual be tortured. But if the Uzbeks regularly tortured people and gave us the intelligence, that was perfectly legal. So at that stage, I was, if you like, put in my place. I was told that it had been decided at the highest levels that we should use material from torture and that it was legal, so I should shut up and get on with my job. That obviously posed me with quite a dilemma as to what to do next. And I realised that if I were to continue to push, then it would be the end of my career. But really, it had reached a stage where I wasn't going to be able to carry on with what had been, frankly, a brilliant career. I was very young to be appointed ambassador. I'd worked my way up very quickly up the ranks. I'd been continually promoted and regarded as someone, you know, headed for the top. And I was going to lose all that. On the other hand, seeing the effects of torture and knowing that the intelligence material we were obtaining from torture was untrue, could I live with that untruth? And could I live with knowing the terrible things that were happening to people in the torture chambers? So it was at that stage a very, very difficult time for me to know what to do.
Within months, rumours and innuendo about Murray were appearing in Uzbek newspapers, suggesting that he was alcoholic and sleeping around in Tashkent. Foreign Office staff had visited to investigate and had interviewed Murray's colleagues.
I was on holiday with my family in Canada, and I was called back to a meeting in London. I was told to return immediately. I got an overnight flight from Vancouver, changing in Chicago. I got a taxi straight from Heathrow Airport to the Foreign Office, and I arrived very dishevelled, having been on 15 hours of flight and not having slept for a couple of days. I went into this meeting where I was told that, given my disagreements over policy, it was felt best that I should resign as ambassador in Tashkent. They said that it wouldn't affect my career, it wouldn't be a disciplinary thing, I could go on and be ambassador somewhere else, less controversial. And I refused. I said I didn't see why I should leave Tashkent. I thought I was doing a good job there. I had a lot of influence there. I thought there were important policy questions that I was having an impact upon. And then, to my utter astonishment, they produced and handed over to me a list of 18 allegations. He said that, you know, unfortunately, these allegations would now have to be looked into. And they included offering visas in exchange for sex. They said I was an alcoholic and habitually drunk. They said, in effect, I'd been stealing money from the embassy, and 15 other such allegations. Like, I can't describe to you, unless you've gone through something like this, it's hard to describe just how you feel when your basic integrity is suddenly questioned, and everything you've worked for and built up is suddenly in an instant cut away from underneath you. It was just difficult to believe it was true, and it was really, really happening to me. And I had 1 week to think about it and 1 week to resign. It was a truly kind of Kafkaesque situation. You felt you were caught in a situation over which you had no control whatsoever, and that very powerful people in government were essentially stitching you up and ruining your reputation. So it really was a quite appalling moment, and the worst moment in my life so far. I refused to resign. The sheer stress of it all led me to crack up. I had a nervous breakdown. I spent some time under psychiatric care for depression. But I refused to resign, and I absolutely denied all the allegations.
By this stage, Murray was still ambassador to Uzbekistan in name, but was banned from entering the embassy grounds. A campaign got underway to prevent his removal, and it had the support of powerful British business interests in Uzbekistan. Sympathetic coverage was appearing in the British press and media.
Fireworks over the British embassy in Tashkent, literally and metaphorically. Speculation has exploded around the ambassador. Friends say Craig Murray was summoned to the Foreign Office in August.
What is happening with the British ambassador to Uzbekistan? You may remember that we reported in the past on the way he was brought home on sick leave amid all sorts of rumours that he was being punished for his outspoken public remarks on human rights.
Some press reports suggest that the Americans applied pressure because Craig Murray antagonised one of their strategic...
Activists and opposition figures believe Mr Murray has been the victim of a smear campaign orchestrated by the Uzbek government.
In the end, a 4-month investigation by the Foreign Office cleared me of all the allegations. They had to let me go back to work. I don't think they'd ever expected to be able to prove any of the allegations. My belief is they always knew they were completely false and untrue. They were simply trying to terrify me into resigning. That didn't work, and I was able to go back and work again in Tashkent, again as ambassador in January of 2003. I returned. And I decided that, really, perhaps I'd done as much as anyone could be expected to. I'd done everything I could to stop the torture. I'd done everything I could to stop us using false intelligence in the war on terror to exaggerate Al-Qaeda. And I thought maybe I'd keep my head down and keep quieter about it. But then two things happened. Firstly, I realised that this kind of false intelligence was being used in the UK to keep people detained without trial in Belmarsh prison for years and years. And secondly, after the truth about Abu Ghraib came out, Jack Straw made a speech in which he said that we were totally against torture and would never have anything to do with it. And I knew that was simply appallingly hypocritical, that in fact our real policy was that torture was a policy, torture was an instrument we would use in the war on terror. So I sent back a telegram to London, which I confess was perhaps in places slightly sarcastic or ironic in tone, saying,
I will not attempt to hide my utter contempt for such casuistry, nor my shame that I work in an organisation where colleagues would resort to it to justify torture. I have dealt with hundreds of individual cases of political or religious prisoners in Uzbekistan, and I have met with very few where torture, as defined in the UN Convention, was not employed. I repeat that this material is useless. We are selling our souls for dross.
That telegram was eventually leaked to the Financial Times. It wasn't I that leaked it, but the fact of its being leaked was used finally to remove me from my post as ambassador in Uzbekistan. At that stage, I decided to go public, and I went on to the Today programme on the BBC. That morning, when I went to the Today studio, I knew that this really was it. This was the end of the line. This was crossing the Rubicon. So I was obviously fairly nervous going there. I was interviewed by John Humphreys, who has a reputation as being quite a fierce inquisitor. So that's enough to make you nervous.
Craig Murray,
whatever your career prospects might have been and whatever the reasons for sacking you, you'll have not helped yourself by coming on this programme, talking to the Today programme about it all. You don't normally hear diplomats speaking in public about their own boss.
No, I think that's true, and I imagine the Foreign Office will be pretty annoyed.
So will you fight your dismissal?
I can't fight my removal from Tashkent. That's a fait accompli. But, you know, plainly my career has suffered, and my health, unfortunately, has suffered very badly, largely due to the stress brought on by the unfounded charges against me, and I have every intention of fighting that legally as hard as I can. And it was that appearance on the Today programme which they used to suspend me finally from the diplomatic service. And after a negotiation of several months between my union and the FCO, I finally retired from the Foreign Office.
Today, almost 2 years after his retirement from the British Foreign Service, Craig Murray works in London as a writer and broadcaster.